This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teik. We are rebroadcasting some of our favorite interviews of the year. Today, we look at progress that's been achieved through the judiciary in 2016. Lee Tree Lin spoke to lawyer Datuk Malik Imtiaz about the case of Runi Rabit, a Sarawakian Bidayuh who was converted to Islam by his parents as a child, but through the courts is finally recognized as a Christian, the religion of his choice.
What are your thoughts about the ruling to begin with?
It's an interesting decision. Because it now puts in play a different way of looking at what is obviously a very vexed issue. We've had a line of authority that has gone down one road, emphasis being on the need for a Sharia exit order. And those judgments had not really considered in depth what it meant to profess a particular religion. Whereas this decision of the High Court now gives some insight into that process of professing and offers lawyers a different way of looking at the issue, which may, in the long run, be useful to solve the problems.
What specific facts do we know did High Court Judge Datuk Yu Jen Kier consider when coming to that decision in her ruling that granted him the leave for judicial review?
Yeah, it's not just leave. I think the court ultimately also agreed on the substantive application to grant relief. From a cursory reading of the grounds for leave, it appears that the judge was influenced by three primary facts. One, that the Sharia authorities were not objecting, and that's interesting. The objection was from the National Registration Department because Runi wanted to have the word Islam and the name changed. And the National Registration Department, I think quite consistent in policy, said that you need to get a Sharia exit order. But the Sharia authorities were not objecting, and that's quite unique. And that may have something to do with the fact that it's in East Malaysia. The thinking here might be different. The second thing was the court looked at the fact that when Runi was converted to Islam, he was still a minor, and was in the custody of his mother. So the decision to convert was not his. It was essentially a parental decision. And the third thing, therefore, the court took into account was the fact that he could not be said to have professed the religion of Islam. And this was underscored by the judge's view that because he had been raised in the Bidayuh community, Christian community, he was really not a practicing Muslim to begin with. And I think those three facts played a big role in getting to the decision and the outcome.
If we could take a slight deviation, something that you said I found very interesting, the idea that the thinking in the courts might be different in East Malaysia compared to what we have here in the peninsula. Mm. How much can and should that, firstly, what does the thinking of the court kind of imply? Yeah. And secondly, how much can or should that influence decisions?
Well, obviously, any judge who's dealing with any particular case has to understand how to apply the law to the facts of any given situation. In the context of what we're discussing, because ultimately it goes back to a constitutional freedom of religion, local circumstances really, I don't think, should have that much of a bearing. Having said that, I think the general sense is that there's a little bit more flexibility on matters of faith in East Malaysia. We've seen statements made by various persons in authority over on the East Malaysian side on the Allah issue, for example, and other similar things. So maybe that had some bearing in the way the judge looked at the situation and offered a different inroad into the same complex problem. So I think answering your question directly, insofar as interpreting the constitution is concerned, there really shouldn't be a distinction between the way judges perceive it in East Malaysia and West Malaysia, because we have a single constitution that applies across the board to all states. Having said that, there's a big argument as to whether or not Sabah and Sarawak are actually states of the Federation to begin with, or whether they stand on a slightly different footing. So I think that's as much as I can say on that.
Coming back to the case at hand, he could neither change the name nor the religion on his my card to reflect his true identity because, as you rightly said, the National Registration Department informed him that a letter of release from Islam and a court order are required. Is this a requirement that is exclusive to Islam when you want to change your religion?
As far as I can see, yes. We only see the cases that end up in court are always cases that involve Muslims wanting to change status. Lena Joy is one of the more obviously controversial cases and more publicly known. And it goes back to a decision of the federal court in 1999 when the federal court said because the Sharia court regulates conversions into Islam, the Sharia court has exclusive jurisdiction to regulate conversions out. And that's a process that has become known colloquially as the exit order. So it's not a letter of release per se. It's actually an order from the Sharia court declaring you as no longer being a Muslim or declaring you as a non-Muslim. And that's what's required by the NRD. And that's not a requirement for any other person of a different faith. So yeah, it's unique to Muslims.
Having said that, are any religions sort of outlawed when it comes to what you want to put down on your MyCard? You know, is atheism allowed, for instance?
I'm not sure, but I can foresee it being difficult for someone to try and get that on his or her MyCard. I think only Muslims have their religious status on their MyCards. Nobody else does.
Having said that, when I went to reapply for my MyCard, they forced me into Christianity without.
But that doesn't appear on your MyCard.
No, I think it's just a part of the information in the back. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it comes back to the officer at the desk who's dealing with you and what his or her thinking is on, you know. But the idea of having the status on the MyCard is to facilitate enforcement of Islamic law, and I don't necessarily agree with that as a policy dictate, but that's the explanation given when we ask. Why is Islam on the MyCard?
Well, we're talking about Islamic law. The Sarawak State Government, the Sarawak Islamic Religious Council, and the Sarawak Department of Islamic Affairs all issued letters of no objection. But JPN objected on the grounds that the matter should be decided by the Sharia court, reasoning that the court should apply the subject matter approach instead of the remedy prayer for approach. What do these two approaches mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the subject matter approach is all very technical. I don't know whether you want me to bore you with the details, but essentially, one approach says because it pertains to Islam as a subject matter, then that's within the jurisdiction of the Sharia court. The remedy approach is because the remedy is only the remedy sought is can only be given by the High Court and not the Sharia court. It therefore goes to the Civil High Court. Those are the two approaches. But actually, all that's been done away with by a decision of the federal court in a case called Latifa Zin, where the court said, look, just consider whether the legislation gives the Sharia court the power to do certain things. If it does, it's there. If it does not, then ask whether the High Court has jurisdiction by federal law. If it does, then the answer is there. And if neither has jurisdiction, then that's a gap that legislature has to fill. So in this case, the approach should be, does the Sharia court have jurisdiction to give declarations on matters of constitutionality, right? And the answer is clear, no, because Sharia court can only give remedies of a personal law nature, dealing with persons professing Islam. Here, you have the National Registration Department of the Government of Malaysia as a party. You cannot say the National Registration Department or the Government of Malaysia is a person professing Islam. So clearly, the Sharia court has no jurisdiction over the NRD. And it should therefore go back to the High Court. And I think that's what is meant by the remedy approach in your question.
Considering, you know, what you said earlier about how the cases that tend to make it into the papers, the cases that we tend to hear about, are all to do with conversions out of Islam by and large. Do our laws in the federal constitution allow for the conversion out of Islam?
Yeah, okay. So that's really the heart of the matter. And I mean, there's so many different ways of thinking this through, but I think fundamentally you have to start with what the Constitution says, and Article 11.1 does say quite explicitly that every person has the freedom to profess and practice a religion of choice. So that means what it means. However, in Lena Joy, the federal court interpreted that guarantee as having an implicit caveat where it concerned Muslims. So every person has the freedom of religion, But for Muslims, that freedom has to be exercised in accordance with Islamic law. Now, how the federal court, I don't agree with the thinking that led to that conclusion, because one cannot simply imply terms into the constitution judicially. You know, it's a fundamental premise of constitutional law, you know. But that's what the federal court, the majority, took that view. So yes, if you look at it from a constitutional standpoint, every person has the freedom to profess and practice. This judge in the Rooney case fixed on the word professing, which I think is the correct starting point. Only the person who professes is able to say what he or she professes. And I recall in one of the many arguments we mounted over the years, I referred the federal court to a decision from one of the Pakistani, either the High Court or the Supreme Court, I can't remember now, where the court recognized that according to the Quran, only God can tell you what's in the heart of a believer. And so who is the court to decide what the religion of this particular person was? But over time, starting with that 99 decision, which I think was incorrect on the law, because the Sharia court doesn't regulate conversion into Islam. It's an administrative process done through the, you know, different agencies. But the federal court assumed that to be the case and then decided by implication, therefore, Sharia court has the power to regulate conversions out. And then because of the amendment in 1988, which introduced this separation between civil and Sharia courts, the civil court said, well, since it's an Islamic matter, let's leave it to them. Okay, so that's how the complexity set in. All the decisions of our superior courts have not said, that Muslims do not have the freedom of religion. There are Court of Appeal pronouncements that say Muslims do have freedom, but they say that that freedom can only be exercised through the Sharia court.
That was Datuk Malik Imtiaz Sawa speaking to Lee Chui Lin about the landmark ruling on religious freedom. After the break, freedom of the press. You are listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn and I'm Chua Antek. Today in our final show of the year, we are revisiting interviews which discuss landmark rulings of 2016. Two court decisions shape the media landscape. I spoke to lawyer K. Shanmuga earlier in the year about these two cases. The first case, this was the one involving the Pahang Menteri Besar versus Utusan Melayu. The Court of Appeal ruled that individuals holding public office cannot sue the media for defamation. Did I get that correct?
So we can only rely on news reports for that case, the Pahang Menteri Besar and Utusan Melayu. The Court of Appeal has not yet released its detailed grounds, as far as I know. It's very significant because it's actually something that I think is a very positive move, where essentially if you're a politician or a public official and you're suing because of things said in your capacity of being a politician, a minister, or a elected official, then you shouldn't be able to sue for defamation. Unfortunately, shortly after that case, there was another decision of the Court of Appeal, different judges in that panel, involving the state government of Sarawak and the MP for Kuching, Chong Chien Jien. And there the Court of Appeal, by a 2-1 majority, said that the state government could sue. So it's a very odd scenario now, because what they're saying is the individual could not sue, the Pahang Menteri Besar, but in Sarawak, the government itself was held to sue, which I think is very unusual.
Did that case release its ruling?
Yes, that case, we have grounds. The judges in the majority of that case basically said that a government can also have a reputation and that they can sue for defending that reputation. And they said that something called the Derbyshire principles, which are based on a case in England, did not apply in Malaysia. They also said that we have a law in Malaysia called the Government Proceedings Act. And Section 3 of that law says that the government can sue just like any other individual and can be sued just like any other individual. And so they said because of that, that means the government can sue for defamation.
But in this Pahang Menteri Services Utusan Melayu Day, I think from news reports cited the Derbyshire Principle. What is the Derbyshire Principle?
So Derbyshire Principle is basically from the case of Derbyshire County Council against the Times newspaper company in England. And that held that essentially if you are, that was a local council trying to sue. And they said if you're an elected body, you can't sue. And essentially, you don't have a reputation as such, as a body. Individuals have reputations. Trading companies have a trading reputation. So a company can sue for defamation if it can prove that its trading reputation is affected. But basically, if you are a political entity or a local authority, a ministry, a government, it's held that you have no reputation aside from the individuals that are members of that body. So the individual council member can choose to sue. Of course, then he must use his own money to pay the legal fees. But Derbyshire County Council couldn't sue and use taxpayer funds to sue for their reputation. So the idea is that if you're elected, whether or not your reputation is affected is determined by the election. And if people think you did a bad job, they elect you out.
And so in the Sarawak case, the judges thought that the Government Proceeding Act take precedent over this Derbyshire Principle.
Yes, because, well, what they said was the Derbyshire Principles were established in England only in the 1990s, I believe. Malaysia, to a certain extent, some lawyers believe that English law is applied in Malaysia, but we have a very funny section in a very odd act that says that our law is sort of fossilized as at a particular date in 1956, and that the common law of England applies in Malaysia as at that date. Now, lawyers, we have highly technical debates on whether that's actually what that section means and how it applies in Malaysia. And that's brought to the fore in the Sarawak state government suit, because the minority dissenting judge said, look, that we don't live in 1956, we live in 2016, and we should develop our own Malaysian common law, and we can import these principles from England if they are consistent with Malaysian circumstances. And he said, well, there's nothing wrong with saying that an elected body shouldn't be able to sue. They have other remedies in order to preserve their reputation, if at all they do have a reputation. And most importantly, what they said was, yes, the government can sue, but what can they sue for? And they can't sue for defamation. That's what the dissenting judge said.
As you mentioned, governments are made up of elected officials. They are temporary while the position is permanent. Mm. What are they protecting then? What is the reputation in the legal sense of a government?
Yeah, that's right. So I think I don't think there is such a thing as a reputation of a government. A government is there to administer the country. The individual members may have reputations, but as an entity, as a political entity, even if they do have a reputation, I suppose that's a metaphysical question, but even if they do have a reputation, what's the appropriate remedy? Governments can issue press statements which will be covered by everybody. The individual person attacking a government doesn't have as ready a means of communication as the government does. And so I think it's wrong in principle to allow governments to sue. When the weight of the government is against you as an individual, the government has government lawyers. I think the government lawyers have some of the best facilities available to them. They have almost infinite resources as compared to the ordinary man or woman on the street who says something against the government that the government doesn't like. So I think it's wrong in principle to allow governments to sue for defamation for mainly that reason.
Moving on to the next case. Mm. This one involves a Bintulu member of parliament, and it's against the former NST journalist Joseph Sipalan. Mm. And it involves an article which Sipalan wrote regarding an allegation that there was a collusion, but he refused to reveal the source. Mm. The federal court, this one was at the highest court, ruled that a journalist need not have to reveal his sources for an article that is written. Is this more significant than the previous one?
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately not, because again, what happened was the High Court made the decision to say that, all right, Joseph Sipalan doesn't need to answer these questions about who his sources were. They were not satisfied. The plaintiff in that case, the Bintulu MP, was not satisfied and appealed. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeal and the Federal Court decided those appeals on a technicality that the trial judge's decision was not appealable. Because what had basically happened is, you know, you have a trial. During the trial, there are numerous objections that are taken by either side, whether or not this document is admissible evidence, whether or not this particular question was wrongly formulated, whether or not this particular witness is supposed to answer the question at all, and that sort of thing. So the judge made the ruling in that context. Of course, this was a very significant ruling with far-reaching consequences. What the Court of Appeal and Appeal Courts and Federal Court basically said was, you can't appeal this now. You have to wait till the judge finishes the case, makes her decision on the main case, and then appeal. So the Federal Court's affirmation of the High Court decision is not really an affirmation of the reasoning that says a journalist doesn't have to reveal his sources. Having said that, what the High Court judge did in this case actually applied case law that applies in other countries, many other countries across the Commonwealth. What they said was, look, a journalist doesn't have an absolute right not to reveal sources. You balance it, right? The public interest and the journalist's right to respect confidentiality. And what the judge said was, here, even though the identity of the people who disclosed the information to Joseph Sipalan was relevant to the case, the public interest of journalists being able to protect that relationship of confidentiality outweighed, in this case, the need to divulge that information. But she said in another case, it could be different.
It's a case-by-case basis. What is the legal status of in Malaysia currently for journalists to use anonymous sources?
So it all depends on what the source is and what the information is. So Joseph Sipalan was a private suit. Basically, the Bintulu MP was suing another political leader, and it was an internal fight within the MCA. And it just so happened that Joseph Sipalan wrote the article. And actually, he was no longer a defendant in that case. New Straits Times and him had basically been removed as defendants in that case. It's not clear why. But then what had happened was the plaintiff had subpoenaed Sipalan to give evidence. And so it's a little bit more complicated. And so this was a private dispute, defamation claim. But what about when a journalist discloses information about government impropriety? What about when like in America, there was a New York Times reporter who disclosed things regarding the U.S. military, and she went to jail because of it, because to the end, she refused to disclose her source. And generally, universally, across most jurisdictions, they say that when it affects national security, a journalist cannot hide behind this cloak of journalistic anonymous sources. If you ask what's the status, it depends on what's the information that was given and really how important it is to see whether or not the journalist is essentially hiding a crime.
That was lawyer K. Shanmuga talking about the landmark legal decisions affecting the media. When we return, two more landmark cases, one about sexual harassment and the other on police shootings. You are listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn and I'm Chua Eun-taek. Today we are taking a look back at interviews on landmark legal rulings. Lee Tree Lin spoke to lawyer Hani Than about an important case on sexual harassment.
So Hani, for people who aren't familiar with the case necessarily, could you briefly summarise the key details of what happened?
Okay, I would say what happened is pretty standard in most offices in Malaysia, unfortunately. So the respondent complained that the appellant had used certain words which were of a sexual nature, and he had also persisted in, you know, asking her out, "Do you want to marry me?" Things like that, you know. So what happened then was she filed a complaint with the employer, their employees, because he's the general manager and she's the senior manager in that company. So what happened was, the company actually did hold an inquiry. But what they found that was his behavior did not reach that standard where they could take any sort of disciplinary action, even though they did, you know, issue out a very stern administrative admonition, I think they call it. And because of that, the appellant, Mohammad Rizwan, he felt that, you know, he was hard done by, that she had defamed him because, you know, nothing was proved. So he filed the action in court. Then what happened was the respondent, who's Asma Mohammad Noor, she filed a counterclaim. And basically she said, you know what, you sexually harassed me, so you should in fact pay me some damages for your actions. So that's basically what happened.
And that went all the way up. What were your initial thoughts when you heard about the ruling?
I couldn't believe my eyes.
In a good way?
In a really wonderful way, because I think we've had a spate of like really kind of not very human rights friendly decisions from the federal court. And to suddenly see this, it's so refreshing, you know, because I think not many people actually see sexual harassment so much as a right, you know, like your right to work. And along with the right to work comes your right to work in a safe environment. And part of the reasons why sexual harassment is so damaging is because it puts you on edge, you know. If it's directed at you, then it makes you fearful, you know. But if it's just generally said, like in the office within your hearing, or if the, in the past, I think there used to be like, you know, naked calendars or, you know, screensavers, whatever. It just makes it for a very hostile working environment.
How do we determine what's considered a safe environment for everyone? Because I think that's where that sort of little friction comes about, because what's safe for some is not safe for others, right? I could have, you know, a nude woman as my screensaver. I don't, but I could, you know, and to me, that's a perfectly fine thing to do. It's, you know, my computer. I can do whatever I want. And to someone else, that could make them feel like I am being hostile or presenting a certain, you know, environment within the office that they don't like.
I think the important thing to look at is actually from the person who's perceiving it. Right. So if you continuously make sexist jokes, you know, or you persistently ask this person to go out or stand very close or eat bananas in a very suggestive way or make certain noises, you know, it's just not good and not acceptable. So I think when that person is telling you, hey, you know what, you got to stop doing this, you have to. Right. So I think that's where the threshold is when somebody tells you this is not acceptable.
So you sounded fairly surprised at the outcome of it. What is noteworthy about the judgment? You know, based on what you've read, based on what was said, what is noteworthy? What makes it landmark in that sense?
I think what it is that I don't believe that our Malaysian courts are so well known to actually create a new tort. So a tort is a civil wrong. And your remedy for a civil wrong are two things. One is actually damages, which is monetary compensation. The other one is what we call an injunction, which is a court order to stop that person from repeating a certain act or to do something. So I don't believe our Malaysian courts are very well known for that. And the fact that they came out and said things very clearly, I think that's quite revolutionary.
How do we define sexual harassment? I mean, while we're talking about it, because again, just like a safe office space, I feel like this is one of those things where we all think that we have some sort of universal understanding of it, but we might not necessarily.
Yeah, actually we don't. But I think the common denominator should be if that person who's feeling harassed says this is not acceptable, that's when you should stop. You know? But I think what the court has come up with in this particular case, it talks about this course of conduct by a person, whether by words or action, directly or through third parties, and I'm just reading from the judgment, sufficiently repetitive in nature, as it would cause and which she ought reasonably to know would cause. I think that's where you're talking about what the mental state is. So which he ought reasonably to know would cause worry, emotional distress or annoyance to another person. This is one type of sexual harassment. I think the other one that the court didn't deal with is the quid pro quo type. You know, sleep with me, I give you a promotion. Sleep with me, I give you more bonus.
Or rather, don't sleep with me and I
and
might make your life
storage
difficult.
You.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, like yep. that. Just to provide some context to why this tort is so significant, what are or were our current laws on sexual harassment?
Before this decision came along and after the 2012 amendments to the Employment Act, there were very limited circumstances under which you can actually bring up this issue of sexual harassment within a workplace. The other alternate at one time that we were also exploring is another tort, which is not really sexual in nature, but the tort of assault and battery. So assault is when you are put in fear of your own safety. Battery is an actual contact. So, for example, if I say, you know, I'm going to kiss you and I come close to you and make like kissy noises, you know, that if you're in fear of your safety, that would be an assault. But if I actually kiss you, that would be a battery. That's something which the women's groups always talked about, but we never got around to doing because the cases didn't arrive in that way. But the most common way in which sexual harassment was dealt with is actually via the penal code. So they have this thing which is called, you know, outraging or modesty. That was a very common one that the prosecutors would use in cases of sexual harassment. But that's very tough also because, as everybody knows, you know, like for criminal matters, then the standard of proof is really high. It's on a, you know, beyond reasonable doubt basis. Whereas here, it's on a balance of probabilities, which is a far lower standard.
What does that mean?
On a balance of probabilities basically means that, you know, if the judge listens to both sides and one side is more persuasive than the other, you can believe that side. That's it. Right. Whereas if it's a crime, then the prosecutor must prove that this thing happened up to that beyond reasonable doubt basis. So if you don't even come up to that that standard at the close of the prosecutor's case, the defense might not even be called. So you will just, you know, get your case kicked out before even the defendant is called to give his defense.
That was Hani Tan speaking to Lee Tree Lin about the federal court decision on sexual harassment. Next, Latifa Koya spoke to me about the police shooting case of a 14-year-old boy. On April 26, 2010, Aminul Rashid Amza was killed in a police shooting incident. Corporal Janine Subi shot 21 times at the white Proton Iswara Aminul Rashid was driving. Initially, it was reported that an armed robber was shot dead, but the 14-year-old, it turns out, was avoiding a roadblock, which turned into a police chase. He died 200 metres away from his home in a Shah Alam suburb. The subsequent court case made national headlines, and Corporal Janine was eventually acquitted for culpable homicide in 2013. The family of Aminul Rashid subsequently filed a civil suit against the police and the Malaysian government. Last month, the Shah Alam High Court awarded the family more than $400,000 in damages. Here in the studio to talk about that ruling is the lawyer representing Aminul Rashid's family, Latifa Koya. Latifa, welcome.
Thank you.
Did I get the facts right of the case so far?
Yes, yeah? Yes.
So when and how did you get involved with this case?
Well, it happened sometime in 2010 on the 26th of April. I think the day after, or rather the evening after the shooting, we managed to get in touch with the family. I think there were many different people at that time who tried to get in touch with the group of lawyers, such as us, who were involved in other cases which involves police shooting or police abuse. That's how we got involved.
So in the original case, what reasons were given by Corporal Janine to shoot at Aminul Rashid for 21 times?
Now, he claimed in his defense that he believed the occupants of the car were potentially robbers who were trying to evade capture, and, you know, they were running away, and that was the basis of his shooting. Mm-hmm. So, but that shouldn't hold water. In fact, that's precisely why we went for the civil suit.
Okay. And at the time, there was a passenger in the car with Aminul Rashid. He escaped unharmed. What was his account of that night and what were they doing?
Yes, in fact, the very fact that was a survivor in such a shooting case certainly helped a lot in finding out what happened on that night. Azamuddin, that's the boy who is Aminul's friend, who's also of the same age with Aminul. He was sitting in the front seat of the car. And he, basically what happened is after the after the car hit the brick wall, he actually tried to escape. And he managed to come out of the car, but he was assaulted. He was beaten up, stepped upon by the police, who by then would have already reached the place. And then he, somehow, because it was dark and it was early in the morning, he managed to escape, even though the police was already wanting to shoot him. He read out his testimony and gave evidence in court that day, and that till today stands. We are lucky that someone survived to tell the story, what happened that night.
Were there other bullets fired besides those that there was were, in the car?
There were certainly a few other there were two or three other patrol cars that followed and chased Aminul's car. And shooting started way before. But most of that, those bullets probably hit the tires and punctured the tires and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it turned into a hot pursuit just because he tried to evade a roadblock.
That's right. That's right.
And in that case, Corporal Janine was originally found to be guilty for culpable homicide in the Sessions Court.
Yes.
But the High Court overturned that, and the Court of Appeal in November 2013 reaffirmed that decision. Why was he found not guilty?
Now, in the case of a criminal case, when a person is charged, the standard of proof would be certainly much, much higher, and it's a beyond reasonable doubt standard. So the court in that case was basically to find only Janine guilty or not guilty of the charge that was found against him, not more than that. So it could very well be there is lack of evidence or proof that needs to actually for a charge like that, for culpable homicide. And intention and things like that will be required. Whereas in the civil suit, which we have sued, we are not just suing Janine as such. We are suing Janine, the police force, the government, for having to be responsible for what had happened, as in the unlawful shooting against Aminul Rashid. The other issue that we need to be clear is that the Court of Appeal, in no way by acquitting Janine, exonerated the police force over what happened to Aminul. So we can't really say that it's a contradicting decision. All right. So that's what happened. So criminal case procedure may have different standards. Civil suits may have different standards.
I'll come back to the standard in a moment. Why was it not brought even further to the federal court?
Okay, that we're stuck with the jurisdiction issue. Because the matter was first charged in Sessions Court, so the last court for this matter would end at Court of Appeal. Had Janine been charged originally at the High Court, then this matter would have gone to federal court. So that is the system where you have only three tiers. So that's the end of for the criminal case in that sense.
Were you part of the team that brought the prosecution?
No, because that will be by the government. So it's the DPP who would have brought the case. And there was the lawyers watching brief on behalf of Aminul's family, but they are not party to that suit. In other words, it's between the prosecution and the accused. In the case of the criminal case, Janine had his own lawyer. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, coming back to the intent and standard of proving guilt, how was that intent established in the criminal case that Corporal Janine didn't intend to murder?
Well, because I did not actually conduct the criminal case as such. Right. It would take more than just to say that there was a shooting and Janine was involved, because Janine would have put in his defense as to why he did that and in what sense, and was he actually... was he really reckless in all sense of the word? You know, so basically, as far as a criminal charge is, it takes a very high standard before one can be found guilty in that. You know, so and he will be facing jail term. So the court will look into every tiny bit detail of what happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as far as evidence is concerned, we I'm unable to tell how much of evidence was actually, you know, provided in court that day in the Court of Appeal in the criminal case. But at the end of the day, the court found Janine not guilty for that particular charge.
That was Latifa Koya, Aminul Rashid's family lawyer, explaining the circumstances of the tragedy. If you'd like to listen to any of the interviews featured today in full, you can do so by downloading the BFM app on your iOS or Android device and search for the podcast. Thank you for listening to Live and Learn. Happy New Year, and we'll be back on Tuesday, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.